Welcome to the Property Lovers Podcast. I'm your host, Dominique Grubisher. This podcast series is all about giving you a competitive edge in your property journey. We'll be discussing little known strategies, tools, and information to help you add value and create wealth through property. Now, obviously, we don't know you or your unique position, so this is not financial or investment advice. It is information of a general nature, and you should always seek professional advice as to your situation before you ever invest in anything. But if you want to play a bigger game in property and want to use property as your vehicle to create wealth and, more importantly, freedom, then you're in the right place. Let's do this. Let's get started. In today's episode, we're going to look at some questions that have come up from our property lovers community. So a lot of you have been asking where you find cheap on market properties. Unfortunately, there's no special source. So there's no secret website that only a few people know about where people list their homes on market for sale a whole lot cheaper. You have to do a little bit of legwork, and it involves, first of all, becoming an area expert, because how do you know what's cheap? You wouldn't believe some website that said it was cheap. You probably wouldn't even believe an agent who told you it was cheap. In fact, I'd suggest you shouldn't ever believe anyone. You should empower yourself. So the first step is to know an area intimately. Most people know the area they live in. Most people who have been looking for properties know the budget that they have and where that can afford to take them. I know that if the house next door for me sold for a couple of $100,000 under market, I'd be the first to be aware of it because I know intimately what property prices are in my street. So if you know the market really, really well, you know when a property is listed that it is cheaper than market value. So the first step is to choose an area and then to pound the pavement in that area. Unfortunately, it is just eyeballing properties and boots on the ground kind of stuff. That's where you meet agents, that's where you get feedback, that's where you see what people are paying. And unfortunately, that takes your time, your effort, and your focus. But there's no hacks here when it comes to finding on-market listed properties that are below market value. And yet they come along every day of the week. I always say the deal of the decade comes along once a week. There are sellers in any market, but especially in a market like this one, who are motivated and who list their properties for sale. Many of us think when we're looking at buying, well, why would you sell for less than market? Why wouldn't you just hold out or not sell at all, wait for a better market? But the fact is that there are some things for some people at certain times that don't really relate to price. If I have to sell, it doesn't matter what price I want, I have to meet this market and take what price this market is paying. That may happen because I need to downsize now, maybe I'm going into a retirement home, maybe it's a deceased estate and it has to be sold and distributed, maybe it's a mortgagee sale or a liquidation or a bankruptcy situation, maybe there are just other factors. Perhaps the homeowner has bought somewhere else and is committed there and has to take a haircut in this market and sell below market to beat all the other competition on the market. Perhaps it's a time sensitive situation. Whatever the case, you'll only be able to recognize these situations by looking at the price. And the only way that you can know that the price is cheap is to know the area really well. Another question that's come up from our community is, how can I be protected when buying and selling property? Not sure what sort of protection that you had in mind there, but there are various things that you can do legally when buying or selling property. For example, property is all registered. So if you're buying property, you've paid a deposit and you've signed a contract, but you haven't yet settled because there's a period between actually signing a contract and getting the bank on board and paying over your money and becoming the owner of the property. They call that the settlement period. During that time, there may be a bit of a risk to the buyer. They have signed up and they've committed and they've got a contract for the property, but they don't yet own the property. So one thing that buyers can do to protect themselves, and which is more common when it's an extended or delayed settlement, there's a longer period between signing a contract and actually settling, the buyer can lodge or register a caveat on the title to the property. And that's registered at Land Titles Office, and that tells the whole world that someone has bought the property and that they have an interest in that property. In other words, it's going to settle in however long under the contract. What that means is that the owner can't sell it, they won't be able to sell it to someone else, or it's a matter of public record and the title can't be transferred to anyone but for the person who's lodged the caveat. They've put their foot on the property and registered something so that the world at large knows that they're going to be the buyer of the property and that there's a contract in place. When it comes to a seller protecting themselves, there are a few things to consider, and one of those is insurance. There was a case once where someone bought, they signed a contract, but they didn't yet own it, and the seller hadn't yet relinquished the title or handed it over to the new buyer. During that settlement period, the house burnt down, but there was no insurance because the buyer hadn't insured yet because they didn't own it. And the seller thought, well, I've sold, there's a contract, and they were uninsured. And so there was a massive legal battle over that. So as a seller, one way to protect yourself is to retain insurance up until the date when you don't own the property anymore. Another question that we have here is, do I need a buyer's agent? So a buyer's agent is someone who acts for you and sources a property for you. They're a licensed real estate agent, and instead of acting for sellers, which is what we see mainly with real estate agents, these agents act for buyers and find them a property and negotiate that property. That can be a good thing to do when you don't have the time, when you're unsure about an area or what you should be paying, or when you don't have the negotiation skills or the ability, or it's a bit intimidating for you to actually go out there and cut a deal. So yeah, they can pay for themselves in time and in money saved if they go in to negotiate for you. However, it's always good to learn these things yourself, and you learn by actually doing. So if you've got the resources and you're time poor to delegate the function of buying a property to somebody else, then by all means, it can be a good investment. However, property is a very personal thing, and it's probably one of the biggest investments you'll make, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You can do it on your own. You don't need a buyer's agent, but you will need time to research the market, get across your numbers, make sure that you're getting a good deal, and negotiate well. But it's a skill worth learning, and it's a matter for you whether you do it yourself or engage somebody else to do that legwork for you. Let's look at another question here. How do I pick the best capital growth areas? Oh, gee, that's a tough one. How long's a piece of string? There are all sorts of gurus who say they can pick the next best hot spots and spots that are growing fast. But it's really crystal ball stuff. There's some indicators you can look out for. For example, is an area becoming more populated, more popular? Is it affordable? Are there transport spots? Is there, you know, public transport, train lines going in there? The other thing that property investors look for when it comes to capital growth and hotspots, they look at infrastructure builds. So apart from transport, are there hospitals and shopping centres and places that make it livable? There are areas that become more gentrified. So they may have been housing commission or poorer areas, but fundamentally they may be close to the city and the money may be coming there. In other words, there are a lot of people buying there, renovating houses, restaurants are cropping up. It's becoming a good area to live in, and young families are moving there, and it's becoming a new hub. So look out for those sorts of signs. But it goes back to the first question, becoming an area expert, which is boots on the ground. Usually when you live in a suburb, you get the vibe of that suburb. You know intimately what's happening. They're building a Woolies Metro on the corner, or, you know, lots of people are renovating. There's more of a villagey or hub feel to it. They're the sort of things that you just pick up by osmosis by living somewhere. And it's the same with being an area expert. If you're visiting it, going to open homes, talking to agents, sitting in cafes, meeting locals, you will pick up all of this information. It's about focusing. There's no magic bullet that will suddenly crop up and reveal the next best hotspot to you that no one else would have ever heard of. You have to hone your scope. So pick an area, spend some time on the ground, drive around the suburb, get the feel of it, and start talking to people, especially agents and experts who can bring you deals. Another question. Someone's asked, what makes better investment properties, units or houses? I hate to be wishy-washy. I love to give certain answers, and I hate saying this, but it really depends. We know that when we look demographically and at all the data and analytics Australia-wide, that houses have increased more in price than units. Units are generally more affordable. They haven't had the soaring price values that we've seen with houses, but units have still gone up significantly in value, and there are some areas where units are just more in demand than houses. Houses may be priced out of the market. For example, if it's a dense unit area, a house may not be attractive. Maybe it's a noisy area, or maybe the house is just way too expensive for the market, and you don't want to be trying to sell the most expensive property in the market. But there may be caveats, or there may be exceptions to this rule. It's really a matter of looking at your situation, your budget, what your end game is. What are you looking for? Is it capital growth? Is it flipping the property? Is it developing it? There'll be all sorts of different answers depending on the strategy, and also depending on the area. So it can get very granular. I know, not much of a certainty around the answer, but what I can tell you is that there is no wrong. In other words, oh, never ever buy a unit, always buy a house. I've bought both, and many of our community have, and done well either way. It's just about knowing your market, knowing what moves and sells there, and understanding your strategy and your numbers. There's profit in all areas of the market and in all deal types and in all types of properties. Another question was, should I sell at auction or private sale? That's a great question too, isn't it? And it's hard to tell, because agents will often, in some cities and states, push everyone to auction. Then there's other states, for example, WA, South Australia, where auctions are less prevalent. So what's the right thing to do? I think what's right is what works. Auctions, from experience, and this is my personal experience, auctions haven't served me well as a seller. Because as a seller, the agent talks a big talk, tells you that we'll put lots of money into marketing, we'll pull everyone out of the market who would be a potential buyer for your property, and then we'll put them all together and they'll bid against each other and push the price up. In a market like the current market though, which is more of a buyer's market, people tend to not bid at auction. They feel like they can get a bargain, they sit back. You don't get that energy and that fear of missing out, the FOMO that you have in a hot market. So going to auction may mean putting all your eggs in one basket and selling yourself short. The great thing about auctions is there's some urgency around it. There's a deadline, a line in the sand, and you force people to commit or to meet that deadline of that sale date and show up and put their money where their mouth is. Problem is, if they don't, then it comes back onto you as seller, and they're saying to you, well, what's your reserve price? Well, put it on the market now and let's see if they bid. And you can be left caught short if it doesn't go the way you want. Even in a hot market, auctions are a bit dangerous for sellers, because sometimes when they go and buy another property and they're committed and they have to sell at auction, and for whatever reason it doesn't move on the day, then they're passed in, and somehow there's a stigma with that, and it's a slippery slope reducing your price from there. With private treaty though, there may be no urgency around it and it can sit on the market longer. Private treaty is usually a good thing if you've got a good agent, and often agents can sell off market just by going to people who may have missed out on similar properties or they have connections in that area. So there's no right or wrong here. I would just say the pros of auctions are that there's a deadline, there's more urgency and energy around the process, but if it misses its mark, you can really be caught short as a seller. How much should you spend on renovations? Again, I'd love to say there's an answer that says, well, it should be 10% of the price of the property. But again, it's really a reverse engineering process. So what could a renovated property sell for? And then working backwards, what would you have to spend on a renovation to get that property to a level that people would pay that price for? In other words, if a renovated four bedroom, two bathroom property is worth $1 million and you found a three bedroom, one bathroom property that's unrenovated, what price would you have to acquire that unrenovated property for in order to accommodate the amount you'd have to spend to turn it into a 4x2 renovated property that people would spend $1 million on? So to run the numbers, and this is just spitballing in my head, but let's say it's $1 million end product. People will pay $1 million in that market, and you've got evidence that properties sell every day of the week when they're 4x2 is renovated for $1 million. Then working backwards, to take a 3x1 and turn it into a 4x2 and $1 million property may cost you $100,000 when you scope that out. So working backwards, let's take that off the $1 million. So $900,000 we're looking at. But then you've got to allow for your stamp duty and your agent's commission and interest and holding costs and all sorts of other expenses. So that may be another, rounding it up, let's just say $100,000. So we're already at $800,000, but then you want some profit for your time and effort, and let's say you wouldn't get out of bed for less than $50,000, then you're looking already at $750,000. You may want to put a buffer in there or a contingency or something else for a moving market. So you may look at an offer working backwards for the 3x1 unrenovated property at $700,000. How should you manage construction and renovation costs in a rising market? Great question, and one that comes up a lot. Allow for it. So a lot of builders should still be able to give fixed prices, especially if they're quoting for a job, they're coming in for the job within the next month. They know what their supplies will cost and the time involved. You should be able to corral them into giving you a price. If it's a longer term thing or there's things that can't be costed, then they can cost them before they actually go ahead for the work. So they can say that they've now spoken to their supplier, they're going to be needing to order the parts or the wood or whatever it is next week, and this is the price. Nothing should come as a surprise, and you shouldn't be signing a blank check for renovation and construction costs. Anecdotally, anecdotally, though, our community saying that what's really difficult is coordinating people and the time frame involved for getting supplies. People have said that anecdotally they're ordering stuff and they're being told, yeah, we'll have that for you in 2023, which is not going to work on a renovation where time is money and holding costs are going to kill a deal. So allow extra time, allow a buffer, and allow a contingency rate for construction. And maybe you want to put in 5% or 10% in case things escalate. But always measure twice, cut once, and don't sign up to anything that isn't set at a fixed price. There will be a time frame where they can fix the price and they'll know what it will cost them in that market to deliver within a few weeks. So get that commitment first. What structure will allow you to build a portfolio in the shortest time? Again, no magic bullet when it comes to structuring. I wish I could say, oh, if you buy in a company or if you buy in a trust, you can buy a whole lot more properties a whole lot faster. Structure comes down more to taxation purposes and your end game. What's your exit strategy? What's the profit going to be in the deal? And what's the most commercial way to facilitate the deal? It may be a financing issue. So, for example, the bank may not lend to a trust, but they'll lend to you as an individual. It may be just case by case, deal by deal. So some people will use a company if they're holding it for the longer term or if they're flipping it for a profit. Other people, it may be because of their tax bracket that it's better off doing it in their personal name. Or in other situations, it may be that a trust structure works better for streaming income if it's a buy and hold and there are family members where it's expedient and commercial to stream the income through beneficiaries of a trust. So that's something for the experts, be it finance, accounting or lawyers, on a deal-by-deal, case-by-case basis. But definitely something to consider. But as far as I know, there's no quick hack via structuring to build a portfolio fast. Better question, a better way to build a portfolio, maybe to find the right strategies, the right knowledge and the right deal type for your situation, as well as the funding to get you there. So lots of great questions there. Love it. Love the engagement. Keep them coming and we'll circle back and have future podcasts that directly answer your questions. In the meantime, happy hunting and congratulations to those of our property lovers community who are kicking huge goals in this market. Well done, guys. If you're enjoying this podcast, we want to invite you to join the Property Lovers Facebook group. To find the group in Facebook, just search for Property Lovers. You'll see the group banner, which has the word Property Lovers Hub on it. It's a community for property lovers in Australia. And just like this podcast, it's been created to give you a competitive advantage so you can get superior results in property. Please come and join us today. And for any other information and all your property needs, please visit our website, dginstitute.com.au, because we've got a lot of other giveaways that can support you on your property journey. Things like negotiation, mental toughness. We've got a lot of mini courses there that can get you in the right space to hit the ground running when it comes to property acquisitions. That's it for today, but really looking forward to giving you more tools, more strategies, more support, and a competitive advantage when it comes to property in our next episode.